but also self-esteem, how to keep a relationship healthy, the roles of men and women in society, etc. My experience with voicing the views advocated in the manosphere in public has nearly always been negative. I have 3 to 4 good male friends who are interested in pickup, and they love it. But these friends are the exception rather than the rule. My parents, beta dad, controlling mom, think my attitude towards women is sexist, and my opinion of ONSs, one-night stands, disgusting. Just about everybody I know subscribes to the Disney soulmate view of relationships, and some of my contemporaries, I'm 21, are even starting to settle down and get married. God help them. Talking to girls in bed about what they find attractive in a man is interesting, if only to see the extent to which they delude themselves, but ultimately counterproductive, since a woman, tacitly, expects a man to know how to express his sexuality. Can we as men ever talk about these things in public? What are your experiences? Before I begin, let me say that I think it's encouraging to see such an insightful question posed by so young a man. From the Matrix. Morpheus. The Matrix is a system, Neo. That system is our enemy. But when you're inside, you look around. What do you see? Businessmen, teachers, lawyers, carpenters. The very minds of the people we are trying to save. But until we do, these people are still part of that system, and that makes them our enemy. You have to understand, most of these people are not ready to be unplugged. And many of them are so inured, so hopelessly dependent on that system, that they will fight to protect it. Every random chump within earshot of your conversation about game, about your changed way of seeing intergender relations, about your most objective critical observations of how women are, etc. Understand, that chump waits every day for an opportunity to correct you in as public a way as he's able to muster. That AFC who's been fed on a steady diet of noble intent with ambitions of endearing a woman's intimacy through his unique form of chivalry, that guy, he's aching for an opportunity to prove his quality by publicly redressing a villain like you for your chauvinism. Even under the conditions of relative anonymity, like the internet, he will still cling to that want of proving his uniqueness, just on the off chance that a woman might read his rebuff and be fatefully attracted to him. This is the bread and butter of the White Knight beta. It's best to assume that most guys who pick up on just your game vibe, to say nothing of overtly talking about it, are going to side with the feminine imperative by default. For practitioners of beta game, which is to say the better part of 90% of guys, this is an organic opportunity to identify with women and engage in the same shaming conventions women use without the fear of having it seem contrived. Now this is the mechanics of it, but the rabbit hole goes deeper than that. For the beta game that our noble white knight is so invested in to work, he depends on an assumed system. He depends upon reaffirming his assumed understanding of how to best achieve a woman's intimacy, sex. He must reaffirm that presumption by defending it and looking for opportunities to show he adheres to the feminine imperative, or the version of the imperative he's been taught to believe. His game, his ego-invested identity, is literally dependent upon that system. So not only is he defending his game and his ego, he's also defending the social architecture that makes his beta game even possible. You see, when an AFC clings to the mental schemas that make up an AFC mindset, it requires a constant need for affirmation and reinforcement. particularly in light of his glaring lack of verifiable success with women, while clinging to and behaving in accordance with the mindset. AFCs are like crabs in a barrel. Once one gets to the top to climb out, another drags him back in. The AFC needs other AFCs to affirm his blatantly obvious lack of success. He needs other AFCs to tell him, "Don't worry, just be yourself." Or, "She's not a quality woman because she can't see how great a guy you are." So when an AFC finally does get a second date, and then finally does get laid, it becomes the ultimate validation for his mindset. See, you just have to be a patient, nice guy, and the right one really does come along. This is when the self-righteous phase begins, and he can begin telling his PUA friends that his game does work. And he's getting some now, without all the positive masculinity claptrap. In actuality, he rationalizes away all of the conditions that led up to him getting the girlfriend, and the fundamental flaw that he's settling for a woman who'd fuck him. But this doesn't stop him from claiming a moral high ground. His long wait is over, and he's finally hit white knight pay dirt. The honor system. The concept of honor that men began has been made to serve a feminine purpose. I have no doubt that the principle of honor dates back from as long ago as we can track human civilization. But like so many other social foundations men have instituted, the feminine will covertly position them to its own purpose. In the introduction to The Art of Seduction, author Robert Greene explains why there was an original need for seduction to be developed into an art. For this, we can look back to ancient civilizations where women were essentially a commodity. They had no overt external power to control their fates. But they excelled, and still do, at covert psychological internal power. And this, of course, finds a parallel in men and women's preferred communication methods. The feminine primary agency has always been sexuality and manipulating influence by its means. Much in the same way that each gender communicates, so too is their method of interacting within their own gender. As men, we're respected when we keep our word, sacrifice ourselves for a worthy cause, even to the point of disposability, solve problems rationally. Our word is our bond, and a whole host of other qualifiers that make us respectable and worthy of integrity. We must be overt and above board, and when we encounter a man who is covert in his dealings, we call him shifty and think him untrustworthy. Even for the most noble of purposes, practicing the art of misdirection is not something men are respected for. At least not publicly. It's just this overt masculine interactive nature that women are only too ready to exploit. In combination with their sexual agency and influence, they use this overt male social interactive dynamic to position themselves in places where they can use indirect power. Cleopatra was an excellent example of this. Sending armies to war by appealing to powerful men's pride and honor, while reserving her sexuality as a reward. Virtually every feminine social convention is rooted in appealing to or attacking male social institutions. A dedication to an idealistic sense of honor being chief among them. The obvious example is, of course, shaming and the do-the-right-thing social contract. In fact, to be a man has become synonymous with living up to a feminine imperative that's cleverly disguised as masculine honor. It's not that women created honor, but rather they've recreated it to serve their purpose. In the biblical Ten Commandments, we're told not to commit adultery. don't sleep with another man's wife, which probably wasn't too hard to abide by when polygamy was the norm. In fact, multiple wives was a sign of affluence.
It used to be the conspicuous consumption of the epoch.
Why then is polygamy a social perversion now? What changes occurred that made polygamy honorable, even enviable,
into a very evil taboo?
Along with language and culture, social conditions evolve. What we think of as honorable today are the result of centuries molding. It's very easy to romanticize about times when honor among men reigned supreme, and then lament the sad state of society today in comparison. But doing so is a fool's errand. Honor, in and of itself, is, and should be, a foundation for men, but it's only useful when we understand it in the perspective of how it can be used against us. Man up or shut up. The male catch 22. One of the primary ways honor is used against men is in the feminized perpetuation of traditionally masculine expectations when it's convenient, while simultaneously expecting egalitarian gender parity when it's convenient. For the past 60 years, feminization has built in the perfect catch-22 social convention for anything masculine. The expectation to assume the responsibilities of being a man up, while at the same time denigrating asserting masculinity as a positive, shut up. Whatever aspect of maleness that serves the feminine purpose is a man's masculine responsibility. Yet any aspect that disagrees with feminine primacy is labeled patriarchy, male privilege, or misogyny. Essentially, this convention keeps beta males in a perpetual state of chasing their own tails. Over the course of a lifetime, they're conditioned to believe they're cursed with masculinity, patriarchy, yet are still responsible to man up when it suits a feminine imperative. So it's therefore unsurprising to see that half the men in Western society believe women dominate the world, male powerlessness, while at the same time women complain of a lingering patriarchy, female powerlessness, or at least sentiments of it. This is the catch-22 writ large. The guy who does in fact man up is a chauvinist, misogynist, patriarch, but he still needs to man up when it's convenient to meet the needs of a female imperative. In contemporary society, we have a very different understanding of what honor was, or was intended to be initially. One of the psychological undercurrents I see in most AFCs is a strong, self-righteous dedication to a very distorted conviction of honor. A main tenet being an unearned, default respect for women, essentially an unearned honor placed on a woman for no other reason than she's female. We learn this, usually, from the time we're children. Never hit a girl. Naturally, this has only been ferociously encouraged by the feminine since Victorian times because it served a latent purpose right up until on-demand, feminine-exclusive birth control was offered, and then prompted the sexual revolution. Today, we still have women using the anachronism that is male honor in a manner that serves their interest, but it's contrasted with a sexually emphasized opportunism. A man's responsibility should be honoring her as the fairer sex while recognizing her independence. The AFC gobbles this stuff up, and in an effort to better identify with her ideals, he begins to convince himself that he's unique, in that he better exemplifies this false virtue, this feminine-defined sense of honor, than other guys. The Savior Schema. Every time a man is being nice to you,
He's offering dick. That's all it is. Can I get that for you? How about some dick? Can I help you with that? Can I help you with some dick? Do you need some dick? Chris Rock. The Savior Schema. The beta male expectation of reciprocation of intimacy, usually sexual, for female problems solved. This is a learned, developed behavior that results from men's natural push to deductively search for the most rational solution to a problem. It's really a linear logic. I need sex, plus. Women have sex, plus. I must discover what is required for me to get sex from women, plus. I will perform, embody, identify with said requirements, equals. Women will reciprocate with her sexual intimacy. Needless to say, this is simplistic at best. But as is the root cause for most of men's frustrations with women. Men have a tendency to believe that women will respond as rationally as they themselves would in qualifying for her stated desires. The manosphere is full of men who can tell you this simply isn't the case for any number of reasons. But sadly, they still think that women ought to live up to and honor their implied agreement. The fundamental flaw of the Savior Schema, also known as Captain Save-A-Ho, is that it is essentially negotiated intimacy. And negotiated intimacy is never genuine. You can fix a woman's flat tire, help her out of a financial jam, fix her a nice lasagna, give her the perfect shoulder to cry on, babysit her kids, and listen to her drone on for hours on the phone. And she'll still go fuck her outlaw biker boyfriend because her intimacy with him is genuine, unnegotiated, unobligated desire. She wants to have sex with him. She doesn't owe him sex. What AFCs fail to understand is that all the financial, emotional, dependable support you could possibly offer a woman is no substitute for raw, unmitigated chemical desire. Some of the most irresponsible, unreliable, poverty-level washouts often get more sex than any dutiful, loyal AFC suffering from a Savior Schema, because there is no obligation. Reciprocity. In the wild, the law of reciprocity and fair exchange is a fairly obvious one. Most high-order social animals have some innate understanding of exchanging resources. In fact, you could argue that pair bonding, family structure, and social collectives are, for the most part, based on this shared exchange arrangement. So it stands to reason that in the course of human evolution, we too developed this innate psychological wiring, thus making men prone to deductively seeing it as the shortest distance between what we have and what we want. The difficulties arise when, perhaps cleverly, women learn to covertly use this innate psychology of exchange within the context of a social framework that gives them a resource advantage for little or no exchange of their own. Thus, women modeled a social norm that mirrors men's natural default position of disposability and placed their attentions and intimacies as unassailable resources, so valuable that no effort on a man's part can overtly merit it. When a woman is appalled by the notion that she should be obligated to have sex with a man in exchange for a dinner and a movie, even over multiple occasions, this social convention is the root of that insult. The protector dynamic. Of course, the flip side to this argument is the protector dynamic, which is the natural propensity for a man to want to provide protection for his mate. Over the course of our evolutionary history, certain psychobiological behaviors proved to be beneficial to the survival of our species. Specific hormonal releases prompt different emotions and behavioral reactions as a response to our environment. Women, for instance, produce higher volumes of oxytocin and estrogen, thus prompting a natural instinctual feeling of well-being and nurturing her children, which also, interestingly enough, is released after female orgasm. The same is true for men. Being generally physically stronger and possessing 12 to 17 times the testosterone levels of women, men have evolved chemical cocktails of their own and thus feed a natural protection instinct when prompted. The conflict comes when the AFC confuses this protector dynamic with a savior schema. The natural feelings derived from his biochemistry only serve to reinforce his savior mentality and solidify it as a part of his personality. Even when a woman's repeated behavior directly contradicts this notion of reciprocating intimacy for help or his idea of protection, the savior schema only rationalizes it as being consistent with a single, individual woman. This, then, is the root of the white knight schema. Exchange protection for intimacy, i.e. sex. And, once again, women cleverly, almost subconsciously so, use this dynamic to arrange a beneficial, but unequal, exchange of resources. Intergender friendship. Ever since When Harry Met Sally was released, there's been a constant droning about the validity of intergender friendships. To even suggest that men and women couldn't be strictly platonic, mature friends, is to invite reproach from a society that's been steeped in notions of egalitarian equalism. If men and women are fundamentally the same, there should be no impediment to developing and maintaining a friendship in like terms to a same-sex friendship. While it would be foolish to think intergender friendships aren't possible, it's important to understand that men and women cannot be friends in the way or to the degree that most people perceive same-sex friendship to be. Now, the natural response to this is, I have lots of female friends. Or, what are you trying to say? I can't have female friends? They all have to be enemies? Which, of course, is the standard binary, black or white, all or nothing, retort, and the trained AFC thinks anyone suggesting that men and women's relations as friends could be anything less than equitable and fulfilling is just a Neanderthal chauvinist thinking. However, they are incorrect. Not because you wouldn't want to actually be a woman's friend. There are fundamental differences in the ways men and women view friendship within the framework of their own sex, and the ways this transfers to the concept of intergender friendship. Quite simply, there are limitations on the degree to which a friendship can develop between men and women. The easy illustration of this is that at some point your female friend will become intimately involved with another male, at which point the quality of what you perceived as a legitimate friendship will decay. It must decay for her intimate relationship to mature. For instance, I've been married for 17 years now. Were I to entertain a deep friendship with another female, particularly an attractive female, other than my wife, my interest in this woman automatically becomes suspect of infidelity. And of course, the same holds true for women with man friends. This dynamic simply doesn't exist for same-sex friendships because the sexual aspect is inconsequential. I understand how stupidly obvious this seems, but remember, we're qualifying the characteristics of intergender friendships in the face of a social undercurrent
that wants to convince us that men and women are fundamentally equal. According to this precept, men should essentially possess the capacity to repress their sexual impulse to the point that it should have no bearing on his rational decision to engage in a platonic friendship. Likewise, a woman should be able to disassociate herself from her hypergamous nature to pursue a completely asexual friendship. And both genders should maturely pursue the friendship for their mutual enrichment. However, reality tells a different story. Girl friends. All of this isn't to say that you cannot have female acquaintances, or that you must necessarily be rude or ignore all women with contempt. That is binary thinking once again. But it is to say that the degree or quality of friendship you can experience with women as a man in comparison to same-sex friendship will always be limited due to sexual differences. Most men will only ever engage in friendships with women that they initially find attractive, which then, of course, is colored by their attraction to that woman. I'm sure the not-in-my-case card will get played and attempt to make an anecdotal case for how much an exception to the rule you are. To which I'll say, even if you legitimately are, it makes no difference, because the very nature of an intergender friendship is always going to be limited by sexual differences. Even if you can legitimately make the case that you aren't now, or weren't in the past, attracted to your opposite sex friend, your other intimate intergender relationships will still modify and or limit the depth of that friendship. Even the best, most asexual, platonic, male-female friendships will be subject to mitigation based on sex. The easy example is, I'm sure you'd be jealous and suspect of your girlfriend were she to be spending any quality time with another male friend. It's simply time spent with another male who isn't you, and you'll always question her desire to do so in favor of spending time with you. Bear in mind that it's also important to consider how women relate with their same-sex friends as a template for their intergender friendships. Remember, each sex uses its same-sex model of friendship on which to base their understanding and expectations for an opposite-sex friendship. Very few men have the patience to sort out how women interact with their women friends. So they opt for the easy answer that equalism gives them. We're all the same. So your male buddies are the same as women. Any guy that's been in the circular hell of being a woman's phone friend knows this isn't true. Girlfriends have a much different dynamic for friendship than do men. But likewise, and by way of her innate solipsism, she's presuming her intersexual friendships will follow along a similar template to that of her girlfriends. And why wouldn't women expect their male friends to conform to their template for friendship? In a feminine-centric world, it makes practical sense for men to realign themselves to women's friendship frame. Men will all too readily tolerate behavior and attitudes from girlfriends that they'd come to physical blows with their male friends about were they to do the same. Since the prerogative of maintaining that friendship is, by default, cast in a feminine-centric frame, women generally wouldn't even think of altering their own interpretations of friendship to accommodate a male perspective. Get it out of your head now that you're even in a so-called friend zone with any woman. There is no friend zone. There is only the limbo between you being fooled that a girl is actually a friend on an equitable level to your same-sex friends, and you understanding that as soon as she becomes intimate with another guy, your attentions will become a liability to any relationship she might want to have with the new sexual interest, and she puts you off. or you do the same when you become so involved with another girl. The female wingman. A lot of guys cling to this mistaken notion that they can parlay a female friendship into action with one of her hot friends. You may have legitimate examples where that might have happened, but for each one, I'll show you a girl who would have fucked you, irrespective of whether or not you had a mutual female friend to vouch for you. That friendship may have been a convenient pivot into another girl, but it wasn't the prior intergender friendship that got you laid. It was that the girl who banged you found you attractive enough to fuck. I'm not denying the utility of social circle game, nor am I ignoring that the conspicuous attention of hot women is good social proof. That's not what the friend pivot is about. It's about assuming a girlfriend will endorse you as a pre-selected potential sex partner. You may think it's great social proof to have some hot friend endorse you as a good lay for her other friends. But women talk. In fact, it's all they do most of the time. Your status as a friend gets transferred to her girlfriends. Why? First, if she was a prior target for you who turned into an LJBF, you already have that as an association of your friendship. Any of her girlfriends that would subsequently date you will know that she was your primary interest initially, not them. Secondly, assuming you even could have a completely innocuous, asexual, platonic beginning to your intergender friendship, there will be competition anxiety with the other girlfriends. This will result in a tendency for the original friend to filter your exposure to which of her girlfriends she finds the least threatening. You have to consider the balance between your value to her as another friend or orbiter against her endorsing you as a potential intimate for one of her girlfriends. Just because you have a girlfriend with a social circle of attractive female friends doesn't mean you'll get her endorsement for the one you'd prefer to get with. To complete the circle here, all of this leads up to understanding that your female friend will never be one of your guy friends. This silly notion is founded on the expectation that your female friend will hold the same interest and have the same reactions that your male friends will. Women are never going to be your wingman. One of the great downfalls of men today is too much female influence in their lives, to the point that it's become stigma. Beware the guy with too many or exclusively female friends. This might make for the plot of stupid movies, but most women are wary of guys with so many female friends that they question their being able to relate with and be men. Part of being alpha is your facility with male interactions. If all your friends are women, this calls your alpha cred into question for a woman. Gut Check by Rollo Tomasi. To see what is in front of one's nose needs a constant struggle. George Orwell. Back in 2003, I lived in Reno, Nevada. I can remember one distinct morning. I was driving from the gym into work, and I was waiting at a stoplight. It was around 8 a.m., and as I slowed and stopped at the intersection, along drives my wife in her car coming from the cross traffic. I knew it was her. I saw her in the driver's seat, and I knew the car because I had bought it. I have to ashamedly admit that the first thing that crossed my mind was that she was running around on me. Instant jealousy. Instant suspicion. I felt that all too familiar rush of chemicals flood my bloodstream as I wondered just what the hell she was doing at that time of the morning in that particular part of the town. I later realized that she had chosen that particular route to avoid an accident that was snarling traffic on the freeway to get to an early doctor's appointment.
But I can't deny that my first impulse, however fleeting, was one of jealousy, suspicion, or potential betrayal. My wife of then 7 years, who'd never in that time given me pause to question her fidelity, triggered, for about 10 minutes, a jealousy suspicion, the effects of which were quantifiable in that adrenaline endorphin rush leading to irrational imaginations. Although I like to pride myself on pragmatism and rationality, I won't deny that my first impulse was suspicion. I think this is a fascinating aspect of our psycho-evolutionary development as a species, so I did a bit of research. It was easy to find study after study of this jealousy effect not only in humans, but primates and most advanced mammals. Hell, even some birds get jealous. All of this is triggered by certain environmental prompts according to situation, species, conditions, etc. A very complex cocktail of hormones is released into our bloodstream when such conditions are met, leading exactly to the feelings and irrationality I experienced that morning. Jealousy is a very well-studied dynamic and one that has latent survivalism functions. Obviously, one of our biological imperatives in this lifetime is ensuring the fidelity in the choice of our partners with whom we've decided to share parental investment or potentially share it with. So imperative is this that our own biologies have evolved to react to even the suspicion of infidelity. This is the root of these very volatile emotions. Sherlock Holmes. One of the more common questions I've been asked for advice on is whether a guy is justified in snooping or spying on a lover. It's always an interesting dynamic because it graphically illustrates the conflict between a man's base, evolutionary hardwired imperative to confirm fidelity in his potential parental investment mate, and a socio-psychological countermeasure on the part of feminization and its primary imperative of hypergamy. That's a lot of $10 words, so let me distill it a bit more. Men are presented with an internal conflict that pits their instinct for suspicion against a social convention that accuses him of trust issues. As with most feminine social conventions, shame is the operative here, but he loses respect whether his suspicions are confirmed or not. If a man spies and or pieces together inconsistencies that confirm his suspicions, he still spied and is therefore guilty of not respecting her privacy. Needless to say, a woman is socially reinforced for trusting her feminine intuition if her suspicions are confirmed. But men cannot win in the game of relationship espionage. To further complicate matters, a man must also struggle with his rational nature in the context of this feminized frame. Logic and rationality tell him that maybe his suspicions are unfounded and that he does, in fact, have a problem with trusting. It's very easy to find reasons why your suspicions are really baseless, but that reasoning still grates against what your gut instinct is telling you. The irony of it is that there's really not much purpose in spying if you're properly spinning plates as you should. Most of the men I've counseled on their suspicions all had one thing in common. They were over-invested in their relationship to the point that they had no other viable options. They had to spy. But in all their stories, each of them were really only confirming things that they already knew. They were willfully ignoring the message in the medium because their hindbrains knew that they had no other viable options to fall back on. They instinctively understood the inconsistencies in their women's behaviors, mannerisms, nuances, etc. They knew and confirmed what had changed, but explained them away for fear of losing her. Men, alphas, with options, don't have trust issues simply because when one of his plates has cause to consider putting him off for another lover, he has two or three more women on his roster ready to fill her place. Gut check. Whenever you feel something isn't quite right in your gut, what this is your subconscious awareness alerting you to inconsistencies going on around you. We tend to ignore these signs in the thinking that our rational mind knows better and things really aren't what they seem. It's not as bad as you're imagining, and you can even feel guilt or shame with yourself for acknowledging that lack of trust. However, it's just this internal rationalization that keeps us blind to the obvious that our subconscious is trying to warn us about. Humans are creatures of habit with an insatiable need to see familiarity in other people's actions. So when that predictable behavior changes even marginally, our instinctual perceptions fire off all kinds of warnings, some of which can actually affect us physically. It's at this point most guys make the mistake of acting on the good communication solves everything feminized meme and go the full disclosure truth route, which only really leads to more rationalizations and repression of what's really going on. What they don't realize is that the medium is the message. Her behavior, her nuances, the incongruencies in her words and demeanor, and how your gut perceives them is the real message. There is an irregularity in her behavior that your subconscious is alerting you to, which your consciousness either cannot or will not recognize. With so many varied stimuli in our environment, human beings had to evolve psychological mechanisms in order to cope with so much information. We simply cannot apply our focus and concentration on every stimulus bombarding us, so we employ a peripheral, subconscious awareness of it until it warrants our attention. A lot has been written about humans' ability to multitask. But it would be impossible to multitask without this peripheral awareness. What the trust issues feminine social convention does is turn that peripheral awareness into a liability in order to promote the agenda of hypergamy. Trust your gut, but don't trust it where a woman is involved. This is a very devious social convention in that it attempts to short-circuit millennia of evolved instinctual cues that confirm men's interest in parental investment while promoting female hypergamy as the primary breeding strategy. How to use the medium. Now, for as much as that all sounds like some grand conspiracy, understand that this all operates under the surface, and for the most part is simply accepted as the norm. Is it possible, not to mention profitable, to flip the script on women? For instance, when you just marginally deny her your, probably far too available, attention, what happens? Does she resort to some vocalized confessions of you becoming distant? Or express some need to rationally communicate to solve a problem? No. Her gut instinct recognizes irregularities in your usually predictable behaviors, and she reacts by changing her behavior accordingly. You caffeinated the hamster, and she takes the initiative to react accordingly, without you having to say a thing more than give her some plausibly believable breadcrumb of your reasoning. Bear this in mind. Women just want to hear the music and dance. They rarely care about the lyrics, or the measure, or the reasons that went into creating the music. Never attempt to explain the medium to her. That ruins the music. Law 9. Win through your actions, never through argument. Any momentary triumph you think you've gained through argument is really a Pyrrhic victory. The resentment and ill will you stir up is stronger and lasts longer than any momentary change of opinion. It is much more powerful to get others to agree with you through your actions, without saying a word. Demonstrate. Do not explicate. Chapter 4, Part 1. Unplugging. Dispelling the magic. Women get the men they deserve. One point I try to make in my roaming about the blogs dedicated to intergender dynamics is reading articles from many different perspectives. When I have the time, I actively hunt down articles that I know I will disagree with. I think it's far too easy to get locked into the habit of seeking out bloggers, articles, and statistics that reaffirm our own particular views. Even within the circles with which we'd be inclined to agree with, there will often be a lot of conflicting viewpoints, such as the recent conflict pitting the MRAs, men's rights activist, versus the PUAs, pickup artist, or game versus MGTOW, men going their own way. I began my own blog with the intent of studying the reasons why intergender social and psychological dynamics evolve, what functions they serve, and develop contingencies or actionable methods of bettering one's life using this information. This is really the core of game. The problem inherent in this, truly unplugging and becoming aware of your own feminine conditioning in general, is that it often comes with a healthy dose of disillusionment. Once you strip away the heady fantasies of soulmates and expectations of happily ever afters, and replace it with a more practical understanding based on reasonably reliable, empirical explanations, what you're left with looks a lot like nihilism. Even for the most staunch realist among the community, there's still a desire to want to apply, however slightly, some kind of magical thinking to the process of connecting with another human being. For other men, it may be some esoteric desire to cast their association in terms of honor, integrity, or respect. For women, it comes as idealization or predestination. I'm not saying this desire to spiritualize these connections is without merit, but I can't help but see the conflict it has in coexisting with the practicality of what we're learning about ourselves. Just in the last 30 years, we've come to understand the biochemical, hormonal natures of our emotions. We know a hormone like oxytocin induces feelings of trust and promotes nurturing. We know that the endorphin-dopamine profile associated with feelings of infatuation, lust, and love is chemically similar to that of heroin. Poof! There goes the magic. We have an understanding of women's ovulatory cycles and the resulting sexual behavior predispositions that are induced by them. Only the generations of the late 20th and 21st are privy to this information. Evolutionary psychology has only risen to prominence as a field of study in the past 15 years. Discomfort and disillusion. All of this makes for some very uncomfortable realizations, particularly when men become aware of this social schema established to keep them in a female-centric reality. Game is simply the most recent countermeasure developed by men to better adapt to this feminine primacy. But it was only possible through advances in both communication technologies, access to globalized information, and new socio-psychological theory. Prior to these advancements, And with the rise of feminization from the late 60s to the late 90s, men were clueless as to their social predicament. From the start of the sexual revolution until the beginning of this millennia, Western masculinity and femininity has been subjected to the greatest deliberate social and psychological restructuring any generation has ever known. And I shouldn't limit that exclusively to Western culture. Now we see this effect filtering into Asia, Japan, even traditionally masculine Latin cultures. As Westernization spreads, so too does its feminization. What have men been left clinging to? The false guilt we've been taught to be ashamed of as part of our past patriarchy, to be sure. But more importantly, we were left with the legacy of that magical thinking. In the face of a yet undefined hypergamy, we wanted to still believe in the sugar and spice myth, the respect her wishes motive, the marriage goal, all of which were, are, still actively reinforced by a feminine imperative that knew its time had come and men were too stupid in their romanticism to know it. That is, until game was conceived. The great and powerful Oz that was feminization is finally having the curtain pulled back on it. In this new age of communication, men globally share notes and come to their own conclusions, and women shriek all the louder as we head closer to the truth. Thanks to its relative anonymity, no longer is there any social stigma to fear from even broaching the subject of how best to deal with women. The great wailing we hear and read from women is less about current social implications and more about having the 30-year social program of feminization being exposed for what it truly was and now is. Yet even in the face of men seeing the Empress with no clothes, they still make appeals to the romantic, magical association men have always clung to before they became aware of a hypergamy enabling feminization. We read cries of, "Man up! Accept your previous responsibilities of being a husband and leader, but don't be overbearing and crush our spirits." In the back row, a new generation of women, the 22-year-olds, scream, "Where's the party?" as they upload a fresh set of nudes in the bathroom mirror from their cell phones. Women get the men they deserve. For all the crowing and publicity of feminine triumphalism, there's still a wonderment at why men are increasingly less and less motivated to play along in their feminine reality. As tough as it is for men to disabuse themselves of their romanticism, it's even more so for women to accept their own natures. In the shadow of the experiment that was 20th century feminization, they're reaping the whirlwind that the matriarchy of the sexual revolution has sown. It's all the more ironic to read the same mothers who created this generation of men lament how their daughters are unmarried and childless at 35. Identity crisis. You're about to hear a response I gave to a guy I was counseling, and I thought it sufficiently insightful to post on the blog in regards to a pretty common topic that comes up. I think you'll agree. Rolo, is it possible to identify with women without compromising yourself? If it is a conscious effort on the guy's part, no. You bring up a good topic, though. Obviously, when I refer to identifying with a woman, this could use some explanation. What exactly is identifying with a woman? The root of this word is identity, meaning who you are and what characteristics, traits, and interests constitute your individual personality. Identity, in a way, is a pretty subjective and esoteric term, kind of like trying to define what art is. It can be argued that identity is what you make of it. While at university,
My field of specialization in behavioral psychology was personality studies. And I can tell you there are a lot of theories and interpretations of what constitutes identity. However, one article that is agreed upon almost universally is that identity and personality are never static and are malleable and changeable due to influencing variables and conditions. A very pronounced illustration of this would be soldiers returning from combat with post-traumatic stress disorder, a very identifiable and verifiable form of psychosis. These men are changed individuals, and their identities are altered from the time they were subject to the psychological rigors of warfare to returning back to a normalized life. Some have the resilience to adjust their personalities back to a somewhat normalized state. Others sadly do not. Yet in each case, the change was influenced by conditions and environment. Likewise, most young men are subject to their own set of personal conditions and environments, and their personalities and identities reflect this accordingly. The guy who's naturally lucky with the ladies is going to reflect this in his identity. The young man who doesn't receive regular female attention for whatever reasons is going to manifest this condition in his identity. The guy who is focused on his own ambitions is going to reflect this in his own personality as well. But for all, when conditions are such that they feel deprived of certain experiences in their own life, this creates a conflict between a former identity and the altering of or forming of a new one to meet the need for this experience. Couple this with the natural chemical hormonal desire for sexual experience, and you can see how powerful an influence deprivation becomes to a man's identity. Far too many young men maintain the notion that for them to receive the female intimacy they desire, they should necessarily become more like the target of their affection in their own personality. In essence, to mold their own identity to better match the girl they think will best satisfy this need. So we see examples of men compromising their self-interest to better accommodate the interest of the woman they desire to facilitate this need for intimacy or sex. We all know the old cliche women are all too fond of repeating. Guys will do anything to get laid. And this is certainly not limited to altering their individual identities and even conditions to better facilitate this. It's all too common an example to see men select a college based on the available women at that college rather than academic merit to fit their own ambitions, or even choose a college to better maintain a pre-existing relationship that a woman has chosen and the young man follows. In order to justify these choices, he will alter his identity and personality by creating rationales and a new mental schema to validate this decision for himself. It becomes an ego protection mechanism for a decision he, on some level, really knows was made for him. This is just one glaring example of this identification, but thousands more subtle ones exist that men and women pass off as social mores and contrivances. The guy stuck in the friend zone who got the LJBF, let's just be friends, line when he attempted to become intimate with his target will happily listen to her drone on for hours on the phone in order to find out how better to alter himself to fit her conditions for intimate acceptability. He will readily change his mind about even his own personal beliefs if it will better fit what he perceives as her criteria for compatibility with her. This is the compromise of identity. To fundamentally and voluntarily alter one's own personality to achieve the acceptability of another. When we are directly and overtly faced with this sort of challenge to our beliefs, we naturally recoil. You are your own person and would resist your employer or your burdensome parents to tell you how you should vote. Political belief. But when it comes to personality and sexual intimacy interest,